Last March, I decided to host my first Oscars party. My friends and I were all huge movie lovers, and we really got into it. We'd bet on the winners, make cocktails themed to the nominated movies, and heckle all the actors in bad dresses. It was one of my favorite traditions. For years, we'd always done it at my friend Trey's house. He was an amazing host, but he'd always be stressed out the whole time. He was just so uptight about having a perfect party. So last year, I decided to make things easier for him by volunteering my place for the party. Everyone thought it was a great idea, and I was so glad that Trey would finally be able to enjoy the Oscars for once. I decorated my house and laid out a bunch of food and drinks that were themed to the movies. All the guys arrived in time to watch the red carpet. We all wore suits and ties, just like we would have if we were really there. Trey was the last to arrive. He looked around my place and was really complimentary. He said he loved my movie-themed decorations. That meant a lot to me, coming from him. We sat on the couch for a while, drinking and chatting. We watched the red carpet, of course, but we mostly just caught up. Our friends Tommy and David told us all about their trip to Cancun. And James had some really funny stories about his new roommate. Trey seemed uncharacteristically quiet, though. I assumed he was just enjoying the moment. The host walked onto the stage and we all got excited. He did his little monologue, and we were all having fun watching, until Trey started to choke. He gasped and wheezed for a long moment, clutching his throat. He looked right at me, horrified.
You poisoned me!
His face got horribly red and his eyes bulged out of his head, then his whole body collapsed back onto the couch. Within seconds, he was dead. Everyone started freaking out. Tommy and David both screamed and held each other, not knowing what to do. James started hyperventilating. I was the only one brave enough to walk over and check for a pulse. I didn't feel anything. The room got silent for a long moment until James finally said, "Did you really poison him?"
"Of course not," I said. "He ate and drank the same things we did."
That was not the right thing to say. Tommy started screaming again.
"Oh God, are we poisoned too?"
"No one's poisoned," I declared. I pulled out my phone to call 911, but James grabbed my shoulder to stop me. "Are you sure you want to do that?" he asked.
"Of course I wanted to call 911. My friend was dead."
But then James explained that if I had accidentally murdered him somehow, maybe by accidentally using an ingredient that he was allergic to, then I'd be arrested. And even if I weren't convicted, there'd be a huge scandal and I'd probably lose my teaching job. He was right. This was my party and I was responsible, but we didn't have any other option.
"Maybe you could just get rid of the body," Tommy suggested.
I looked over at him, incredulous. How could he suggest such a thing? Trey was one of my closest friends. The horror of his death hadn't even sunk in yet. And now I had to consider dumping his body somewhere? No, I couldn't do that. I started dialing 911, but before I made the call, I decided to check the body one more time. I still didn't feel a pulse. Then I searched through his pockets and found an empty vial marked with some long, sciencey name. It looked like a chemical. But why would he have that? I read off the name and James Googled it on his phone. He read the Wikipedia article to us, explaining what the chemical was used to incite temporary paralysis. It slows down the heart rate to an undetectable level, mimicking death for about an hour before its effects wore off.
"Oh my God," I said. "He's not dead at all."
"He fake poisoned himself to freak us all out."
But why? It didn't make any sense.
Then I realized it was all because of my stupid party. He wanted to upstage me. He was mad that I'd offered to host the party and wanted to bring all the attention back to himself. It was literally the dumbest, pettiest thing I'd ever heard. Slowly, my friends figured out the same thing I did. Trey had always been a dramatic person, so this seemed like something he would do, even though he'd never gone quite this far before. The ceremony continued on the TV, but no one was paying attention. We all huddled in the middle of the room trying to figure out what to do.
We didn't need to call an ambulance because the effects would wear off. We could just leave him there, and when he woke up, we'd just pretend that we hadn't noticed. I thought that would be a nice way to handle the situation. He'd get infuriated if he thought that we didn't care about his stunt. But then I got a darker idea. Let's bury him alive, I said.
What?
James shouted. I explained that I had a trunk in my garage that was big enough for Trey's short, thin body. We could stick him in there, and when he woke up, he'd think that we freaked out and buried the body. When he'd start screaming, we'd let him go. Everyone liked my idea. It was twisted, but then again, so was Trey's prank. So I dragged the trunk into the middle of the room, and my friends helped me lay his body inside. I closed the lid. Then we all sat back on the couch and continued watching the show. We started having fun again. Honestly, I kind of forgot that Trey was even there. After an hour, we all heard movement in the trunk, then screaming and pounding. Trey had woken up. My friends and I just sat there, listening to him scream for the longest time. He was begging us to let him out, screaming that he was still alive. After several minutes of that, I walked over and opened the trunk. He popped out, frantic and sweating.
"You buried me!" he shouted.
I shrugged. He could see that he was still in my living room. He knew that it was all a big joke. But then he grabbed me by the shirt and got in my face.
"You'll regret this, you ass! I've got more of the chemical, and when you least expect it, I'll give it to you. And then we'll see where you wake up!"
Then he wiped his face, glared at my other friends, and stormed out of the room. We all laughed about it, but every day since, I think about what Trey said. Is he really going to poison me when I least expect it? Would he actually do that? I've avoided him ever since, but I'm still scared. I don't go out to eat anymore. I'm always paranoid when I cook anything for myself. I'm just waiting for Trey to follow through on his promise.
The blossom tree had always been there for as long as I could remember. It sat on the very edge of the graveyard that my house overlooked, and every year, at the end of March, it bloomed. There was one thing that made it stand out from the other cherry blossoms in town. Instead of pink or white, this one had petals the color of blood. The fact that it had been planted in a graveyard could be considered strange, too. It didn't quite fit in with the dark hues of the gravestones or the somber oak trees that grew around it. It was a splash of color on a monochrome canvas, a splatter of blood on dark soil. It was approaching the last few days of March when I noticed the petals had yet to open. Blossoms could be finicky with their timing, but I had never known this one to be late in the many years I'd lived there. It should have opened by now, and for some reason, the emptiness of it was bothering me. One morning, I decided to go down and take a look at the blossom myself. Although I lived on the edge of a graveyard, nobody I knew was buried there, and I had never had a reason to visit, nor had I ever taken a look at the cherry blossom up close. It was a damp March morning. The soil was wet and squelchy, and the air trembled with a light drizzle. Was the weather the reason why the cherry blossom hadn't bloomed yet? I wasn't very knowledgeable about botany, so I could only guess. I approached the gate to the graveyard and opened it with a soft creak. It was still early, so the graveyard was empty. The overcast sky cast a dismal pall over the rows of cracked headstones and filled me with a strange feeling of despondence. I had been living by the graveyard for several years now, but I had never really thought about the fact that I was so close to a place of death. Nothing but bones beneath my feet. I shivered despite the mild temperature and walked between the graves toward the bare cherry blossom. Without its bright petals, there was something skeletal about it, like pale, reaching fingers, stripped flesh. I shoved my hands into my pockets, still shivering. Why was I doing this? Why did I care whether or not the cherry blossom was late to bloom? What did it have to do with me? I wasn't sure, but I was already here, so I told myself to keep going. I hadn't realized how big the graveyard was from simply overlooking it. The grave stretched on in every direction, and every step barely seemed to bring me closer to the blossom. The further I went, the more dilapidated and cracked the headstones became. Wrought with ivy and moss, the names barely visible beneath the clods of dirt obscuring them. These were the forgotten ones. Even in a month like March, a month of new beginnings and new life, these graves sank eternally into loneliness and decay. I finally reached the cherry blossom and stopped just short of its searching branches. Closed buds, like tiny clenched fists, peppered the branches. They still showed no sign of opening. Part of the trees almost looked as decayed and withered as the ground around it. From a distance, it had always looked lively and healthy. But up close, the cracked bark and shriveled petals told a different story. I found myself reaching out towards the tree. I wanted to touch one of the tiny buds, perhaps under the naive inclination that it might bloom beneath my touch. I stepped forward, ducking beneath the wider branches, and stretched my hand out. The second my finger touched the bud, something sharp and unseen pierced my skin, pain twinging through my nerves. I withdrew a sharp hiss, blood welling to my fingertips. There was blood on the blossom too, little droplets of red staining the pale bark. What had cut me? I couldn't see anything sharp, no thorns, no jagged piece of wood. As I watched, the blood slipped between the cracks in the bud and disappeared, as if it had never been there at all. I frowned and stepped back. A strange chill worked its way through my body, and the sky seemed to grow heavier. Sensing an impending downpour, I decided to take my leave for now. As I left the graveyard, I realized I was no longer alone. An old woman with gray hair and shriveled skin was watching me between the graves. I offered her a faint smile, but she did not return it. Her lips were moving, but I couldn't quite hear what she was saying. I stepped closer. The March tree will bloom again. I blinked at her, trying to understand the meaning of her words. Pardon? I said. The March tree will bloom again, she murmured, her voice carrying on the breeze. Okay, I said, turning away. I took a step forward and gasped when something grabbed my arm. It was the woman. She had moved closer, though somehow I hadn't heard a trace of her footsteps. She had a strange glint in her eye, her lips cocked into a twisted smile. The March tree thanks you, she said, her voice a breathy whisper that made my skin crawl uncomfortably. That's great, I said, trying to slide my arm free of hers. She finally let go and walked away, muttering under her breath. I shook my head and left. Some people were really odd. That night, I dreamt of the cherry blossom in the graveyard. I dreamed of its dark blood-red petals as it stood against the grayness of the cemetery. I dreamed of the bones crushed beneath the ground, the body sown with its roots. When I woke the next morning and looked out of the window, the cherry blossom had finally bloomed. Its petals were a dusty pink to start off with, but I knew over time they would take on that reddish hue that made this particular tree so striking. If only I had known what it would cost. The next few days were strange. Every night, I would dream of the blossom tree on the edge of the graveyard, and every morning, I would wake to find the petals a deeper shade of red. That wasn't the only thing that was changing either. With every day that passed, I seemed to grow more haggard and tired. My body felt constantly drained, and I would feel lightheaded and nauseous after only a little bit of strenuous activity. When I glimpsed myself in the mirror, I noticed that my skin had taken on a strange chalky pallor, like I wasn't getting enough sunlight. My body was failing me and I had no idea why. I felt so weak, so frail, like the smallest thing could break me. Deep shadows appeared beneath my eyes, sucking the color out of my skin. I became a ghost, pale and hollow and fragile. Then, on the last day of March, I could no longer get out of bed. My body had completely given up on me. I was like those old gravestones, crippled and weakened and forgotten. I knew somehow that I would not be part of the living for much longer. Just before I slipped into darkness for the last time, a voice echoed in my mind, a strange, breathy whisper. The March tree thanks you for your sacrifice. I worked at Costco for about a year and a half when this all happened. My mom is an avid Costco shopper, so she knew the manager pretty well. After some schmoozing, she was able to help me land a part-time job in the food court so I could start saving for college. It was a pretty easy gig. Most of the food comes pre-prepared, so it's just a matter of putting it in the oven and taking it out at the right time. Some things require a little work, like the smoothies and ice cream, but they aren't complicated. You do some measuring and pour the ingredients into the machine. That's it. I learned the ropes pretty fast, and I enjoyed the work. It gave me something to do after school, and I got some extra spending money. After about a year, they asked me if I would be interested in training people. They promised I would earn a small bonus for each person I trained. With the extra cash to motivate me, I agreed. I trained one person before Brian. Her name was Marcia, and she was in her 50s. She wanted to bring in some extra money to help her husband pay the bills. I thoroughly enjoyed training her. Not only was she a joy to be around, but she got the tasks down pretty fast. Honestly, training Marcia was such a breeze, I thought I must be great at training. My outlook changed when I met Brian. Brian was about my age. His face was covered in acne, and he wore thick spectacles that made his eyes appear much larger than they were. It was easy to tell he was uncomfortable in his own skin. Being the same age, a teenager, I get it. I had insecurities, but I was fortunate that they didn't hinder my ability to socialize like Brian. I picked up a weird vibe from him, but I tried to give him the benefit of the doubt. I told myself, he's probably just shy. Give him a chance. As I trained him, the vibe I felt grew stronger and stronger with each shift. To start, he was a pain in the ass to train. It was like every night he would go home, put his mind through a rinse cycle, and forget everything I showed him. Because of this, I would start each training session by recapping what we did the prior shift. Brian also asked the weirdest questions. His questions never really pertained to the work we did. He would ask things like if I ever added stuff to the recipes. His exact words were, "Have you ever tried putting your own twist on the pizza?" I asked him, "What do you mean? Like, add jalapenos? Marsh and I sometimes do that when we close and split it." "Not really," he responded. "Do you ever bring your own stuff from home to add to the food?" No. "I use what we have on hand. I think that would be a major violation of policy to do something like that, so maybe don't." He shrugged, and I continued to show him how to cook pizza. There were other weird things, like customers almost always had an issue with him. We had to permanently put him on food prep because he made people so mad or uncomfortable. I overheard conversations he had with a customer, and he would ask really personal, inappropriate questions. One time, I heard him ask a woman if she trusted her husband, or if she ever thought he would cheat on her. I had to narc on him for that. Our manager talked to him, but after Marcia heard him telling people how to navigate the dark web, we banned him to the kitchen. Marcia claimed she once saw him watching a snuff film on his phone on a break. She said, "He wasn't even trying to hide it. He was sitting out there in the food court, watching a guy cut someone's head off. He was giggling." She told me she planned to keep her distance after that. I trust she knew what she saw because Marcia wasn't a gossip. She seemed very disturbed by him after that incident. Problems began to arise when more and more customers started complaining about being sick after eating our food. Usually, it was the churros and pizza that gave people food poisoning. We cracked down on everything. We cleaned better, checked dates on everything, and essentially improved and sharpened all of our practices. But the problem persisted. It got so bad, they shut down the food court for a couple days and had a couple health inspectors come to investigate. They couldn't figure out what was happening either. They reopened the food court, and people continued complaining about food poisoning. Management looked at all the complaints and realized the only customers getting sick were those who came at night. The only people who worked at night were Marcia, Brian, our night supervisor, and me. All of us said we had no idea what was happening. Marcia pulled me aside one night and told me she wondered if the problem was Brian. It was hard to discern whether it was our distaste for him or if he could actually be poisoning the food. Once she brought this up to me, I said, "Just because someone is a little off doesn't mean they would do something as extreme as poison people's food, right?" Marcia shook her head and reminded me she saw him watching a snuff film. She went on to say, "Ever since then, I've kept my distance. Only disturbed people watch stuff like that." I couldn't deny she had a point. Someone once explained to me a gore they saw, and the description alone was enough for it to haunt me for a week. I still wanted to give the guy the benefit of the doubt. I didn't think I could come across someone that evil. That changed when I walked into the kitchen and saw Brian holding a quart-sized plastic bag filled with what looked like a white powder. He was dumping his white dust into the smoothie mixture. "What are you doing?" I asked immediately upon seeing him. "Oh shit," he said. I caught him off guard and he stumbled down the ladder he was standing on. "What is that?" At first, I thought it was a rat poisoning or some kind of substance. I wish I were right. I walked up to him and ripped the bag out of his hand. "Is this glass?" My temper rose. He mumbled something I couldn't make out. Brian was flustered being caught in the act. He struggled to get out. "I can explain. Just let me explain. Don't tell anyone." "Don't tell anyone you're putting glass shards into the smoothie mix? Are you insane?" His face turned bright red, trying to think of something to say. He panicked and ran out of the kitchen. I went to my supervisor and told him what I saw. I asked my supervisor what we should do, and he told me they would fire Brian immediately. I asked, "But what's stopping him from getting a job somewhere else and doing this? Since we caught him before he harmed someone, our hands are tied." We cleaned out the smoothie machine, but to be safe, we didn't sell any smoothies that night. Unfortunately, we did sell one ice cream. The customer took one lick, and their tongue was set ablaze by microscopic cuts. Blood gushed from their mouth, and they had to be rushed to the emergency room. I know the customer ended up being okay, but I couldn't help wondering how they fixed that. The customer's tongue had the smallest shards of glass stuck in their tongue. I doubt the shards were very visible to the human eye. Because someone was harmed, we were able to report Brian to the police. When the authorities searched his bedroom, they found a journal that recorded everything he did to the food. He used everything from laxatives to rat poisoning to his own urine and feces to tamper with the food. When they told us, I threw up. I probably ate some of the food Brian mixed with his poop. Marshall looked at me and said, "I told you." We closed the food court down and deep cleaned it. We knew the problem was Brian, but we still felt like a deep clean was necessary, just in case. As far as I know, Brian is sitting in a juvenile detention center somewhere. I just hope they keep him there for a long, long time.
I thought of my dreams and how close I was to achieving them, and it brought a smile to my face. Hard work paid off. My habit of saving up made what had been a desire a feasible reality. The warm sunlight washed the smile into a proud beam, angling the expression. My lips parted in thanks. Someday now, any day now. I repeated my mantra, which had kept me focused on the pizza delivery job through circumstances good and bad. It was that vision of near success that would keep me through everything. The box in my hand was still warm. The fresh smell of pizza lined my nostrils. A familiar scent that meant one thing and one thing only. It would be a good delivery. Another tip towards my computer systems and a start in my IT journey. A smart picture of myself sitting in front of my biggest idols in Silicon Valley flashed past my mind, and my cheeks almost hurt from smiling so broadly. "Number 69, I mouthed, and a chuckle slipped from my lips. It was the delivery address, and the more I thought of it, the more I realized it was funny. Life was funny. The house was a small bungalow with a wide porch. The lean, fibrous wooden beams supported the canopy of the ceiling over the home. It looked renovated, the overall appearance of decay still perceivable from its fading white paint. Whoever lived in such a weathered house, I reasoned, definitely would not tip a lot of money. But that would not matter too much as long as the job paid. I turned and marched in the direction of the building. I stopped at the bottom of the stairs and looked up at the door. My mien turned curious when I saw that the door was ajar. That was a strange thing in such a neighborhood. I assessed my position, and the street was empty. Whatever person or people lived in the house knew audacity. Maybe it was simple, and I was overthinking already, but my gut was intent on something awry. One step forward, and I took a gingerly breath. My mind roamed fast, yet it settled on nothing. There was too much to expect. I had seen enough of the job to know that there was no limit to human weirdness. My small mustache collected a nervous sweat, and it made me tickle. I wiped it with the back of my hand. What if? I paused when my heart snapped sharply. The smell of the pizza drowned in my anxiety, and my hand held the pizza box numbly. There was a reason not to move too close to such an obvious sign of danger without announcing one's presence. What if the person inside of the house was in danger? I reasoned. I was no cop. How could I help them? Hello? Is anybody home? I hollered, knocking on the wooden bar. I drew a long breath into my lungs and called out again. The second time I called was received with a grating response from within the house. I took one step back from the stairs and waited. The door yawned and it was pulled even wider. A bald man tucked his head out through the gap and smiled.
Are you the pizza boy?
He asked and stood up straight. Yes, sir, I answered, shoving the box forward to corroborate my response. The man hesitated and looked around the street. I thought it was odd that he would do that, but the man had an inviting allure, so I shrugged it off.
I've got something going on in the house. Do you mind helping me bring it inside while I get the money?
The man pressed, leaving little time for me to reflect on his response before he turned around, disappearing into the house. I contemplated my move with the box of pizza still in my hands. The door was open, and the man had gone in. A fuzzy thought turned my vision blurry. I had to be overthinking, I thought. Nothing about the man seemed amiss, even though I sensed something was wrong. I completed the steps up the porch with a clear head. Hey, I'm just gonna keep the pizza here, I said into the empty house after scanning around the furniture and effects.
And then leave?
My heart jumped when the man's voice came from over my shoulder. In a panic, the pizza flew from my grip. The hair on the back of my neck stood on end, and sudden terror, like a noose around my neck, gripped me. Strong hands grabbed my shoulder and pushed me forcefully against the sofa. I stumbled, tumbling to my side as confusion and dread contorted my facial features gloomy, leaving me paralyzed with fear. I just came to deliver pizza, I cried in alarm. The man moved over to the door casually, with no mind for the intensity of the moment. He looked into the street, and satisfied, he slammed the door behind him as he returned into the room.
You'd be delicious,
the man said, licking his lips with implication.
What?
My butthole puckered.
Human flesh is delicious. Unfortunately, you won't get to try it,
the man said, wide-eyed. A slew of spittle slinked from his mouth, and he pulled it in with his hands. I noted the man's eyes, and realization came like a dangerous bolt of lightning. Little wonder the energy around the house did not feel right. I had never encountered a cannibal, so there was no way I could have known. But sheer evil always felt off. It shocked me to think that it was possible. The man's mouth still drooled with saliva as he walked towards me, and the world closed into a small space. The glare in the man's gaze proved his fidelity, even in his evil. My skin crawled, and I stammered as I picked myself up from the floor.
No! You'll take your pizza and I'll leave,
I resisted, wrestling back my fear. My dream and all of my plans were so achievable now. This man could not steal it from me, I decided. My will to fight for that fancy office in the big leagues of my chosen career proved itself. The man quickly turned red from blushing, and I staggered backward, panting and panicking. My legs struck the table, and I flinched upon contact. Fuck! I bellowed and grabbed my chest to ease its reckless beating. Look, mister, don't play games. The pizza's ruined, but I can get you another one.
I should steam you up before the oven, or just refrigerate you. You're not as meaty as the others,
the man said.
You monster!
I cried when I realized the futility of begging.
Come here,
the man said and lunged at me. I pinched my toes to the ground, and with nimble athleticism, I maneuvered from the direction of the man's reach. The man was sluggish, and I capitalized with quick movements by shoving him from behind. The man cried as he stumbled into the table and tripped, crashing face first into the wall.
My nose!
He cried out. You killer! I hollered as I rushed to the man's side. With one deft motion, I kicked the man's head against the wall when I noticed him trying to pick himself up, effectively knocking him out. Cops are coming for your butt, I said, as I picked my phone up to make the call to the emergency center. The cops arrived moments later, and it was only then that I could breathe again, watching him stir without rising. I took the compliment as a hero who had stopped a serial-killing cannibal, but I never quite shook off the horrors of that moment.